Today, we welcome Leela Stewart from Canada onto the show. And Leela is just such a wise woman who's been in yoga and somatics for so long. There's so much goodness that came from this episode. I learned so much. I think one of the biggest things that you can expect as you listen for the next hour is this idea that the anatomy that we learned dissecting and, you know, memorizing all the bones and the joints and the muscles, that is not the anatomy of the modern yoga person. That's important to learn all of those origins and insertions and joint types, but it's so different than the lived experience of your anatomy inside of you and how it functions with your nervous system, with your thoughts, with your mind, that this lived experience is how we're really, really going to not only learn anatomy for ourselves and start to feel our bodies again, but it's really the only way to teach it to those that we love, especially for those of you that are yoga teachers, yoga therapists, somatic body practitioners, that through learning your own internal experience of anatomy, can you then share it with others? And one of the things that I talked to Leela off camera about was this lifelong journey of moving from kind of being a type A person who's a go-getter, who maybe even disconnects from their own body to pay attention to the external stimuli out there so we can be successful and work harder and produce more, that the journey of lived experiential anatomy is to deconnect, to de-link the senses from all of that external stuff out there, turn the senses and the mind inward, as we know in yoga, we call this pratyahara, so that we can start to feel and sense and respond to our own sensations and feelings inside with self-compassion. And that when we are able to do that, to turn inward and feel again and have self-compassion and respond with appropriate lifestyle, appropriate choices, work habits, sitting habits, sleep habits, food habits, hydration habits, when we can really start to feel what our body is needing, that's when we heal from things like chronic fatigue, autoimmune diseases, chronic pain. So it's through turning inward that we begin to understand what our body needs. And then one last thing I want to kind of just plant a little seed here for you before we get into it with Leela. That is, sometimes we think that when we have a lot of pain or suffering, when our body isn't functioning the way that we want it to, that we need to close down and do less and stay home and make our life smaller. And I can understand that. I've been through chronic pain. I get it. But what Leela had done, which is so fascinating, is that she found her dharma. She found her purpose. And through fulfilling her purpose and staying focused for a couple of decades on this purpose of bringing experiential anatomy to the world, she has in turn healed herself, which the consequence of that is that now she's out in the world more teaching, offering, being of service to the world. So I guess what I want to tell you is that sometimes when you feel like shrinking and having a smaller life, maybe you just need to find your purpose, and that will actually heal you. The game is not over. There's still hope. So go inward and find your purpose. All right, let's go meet Leela. Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Yoga Therapy Hour. This is Amy Wheeler. We're in the second half of 2025, and we've spent this entire year telling stories of health, healing, and beyond with yoga therapy, yoga, and Ayurveda. I hope you'll join us for the second half of the year, where we hear people who are courageous and generous and authentic and kind, telling about their life experience so that they can help others out there who might be going through something similar. Let's get into season 9 and hear more stories about people just like you. All right, on to the show. Good morning. Welcome. We're so happy you're here with us.
I am very happy to be talking with you in person.
You know, we've emailed for many, many months, not just preparing for this conversation, but just communing together. And because it's been an email, I've never have gotten to ask you, do you say your name Lila or Lila?
Lila.
Wonderful. So where are you joining us from today, Lila?
I live in a small town just south of Vancouver, right at the U.S. border. I can see Washington across the bay there.
Wonderful.
From my window. Yeah.
And you've just gotten home from a long trip. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, my meditation practice is really important to me, and I am a dedicated meditator, and I've been initiated into a lineage. And so every year I try to go to 10-day, it used to be 2-week or 15-day, but now it's only 10 days, meditation retreat near Bangalore with my spiritual teacher. And it's very primitive. The beds are really hard. The pillows are all lumpy. You get a bucket of hot water at 5 a.m. and you meditate for many, many, many hours a day.
Wow. We'll get into the whole Panchakarma thing, but I also wonder, do you sometimes pair your cleansing and Panchakarma with the retreat and meditation?
I haven't. The meditation retreat is in the summer, and I tend to go for Panchakarma in the winter.
Okay. We'll get to that. Let's go all the way back and start at the beginning. You had written me that twice in your life, yoga and Ayurveda had completely saved you. So where do you want to start with your story?
And then that saved me a third time, but we'll get into that. Okay. So I got into yoga when I was 19 because I had hurt my back. I was a landscaper first year out of university. And at age 19, of course, I knew nothing about my body. And I didn't know how to take care of it, doing that hard work. And I was also on a work canoe team. So I was always paddling on one side. And by the end of the summer, I could barely walk. And when I went back to university, I was so uncomfortable sitting. I was having to shift position every few, 10 seconds, 30 seconds, crossing my legs, sitting cross-legged in the desk. I was so uncomfortable. And a friend said, my mom is doing this thing called yoga, and it's supposed to be good for your back. That was in 1973, 74. And there were not very many yoga classes around. I couldn't find any. So I bought a book written by a Canadian guru. It's called The ABCs of Yoga by Karine Zebroff. And I taught myself how to do yoga. And I found that if I spent 30, 40 minutes every morning, I could get myself out of pain. And I could do things during the day, like a forward bend, or put my foot up on a chair and do a lunge or do a twist. And that would settle me enough to be out of pain. And I managed my back pain like that for about, 15 years, until I actually found my first real yoga teacher and did my first yoga teacher training. And yeah, so that was the first time. And because yoga for me has always been associated with therapy, with healing, that's all I've ever thought of it as.
So quick detour. Thank you for sharing that, because just knowing that you have the self-empowerment to get yourself out of pain is so powerful. But what you just said really strikes me, that yoga had always been therapeutic for you. Do you see a big difference between therapeutic yoga and yoga therapy? I'm having this discussion with a lot of people.
Well, because I've taught yoga therapy for so long, I do have a distinction. So for me, the distinction is that therapeutic yoga can be taught by any yoga teacher. But yoga therapy can be taught only by a trained yoga therapist who has the extra information, the extra knowledge, experience, and qualification. There was no accreditation when I was teaching my course, except for the last cohort. And so I gave a certificate, and that meant something to people. Yeah, so now I think that the accreditation process is important. But now with all the stuff that's going on with IOIT, I'm not so sure.
Yeah, you know, I don't want to sidetrack your story, but I think these are important discussions for us who've been in the field for a long, long time to be talking about. So
I was on the IOIT Committee of Schools from its inception, so I was in on all the conversations. I think you were too. And I was advocating for tiered accreditation, so a 300-hour, you know, on top of a 200-hour, 300-hour, 500-hour, and then 1,000-hour. And no one was interested in that. No one even commented on it. I wrote an article on it that was published in Yoga Therapy Today, and it was just a non-starter.
So the lower levels, maybe the 300 and 500, could be therapeutic yoga leading to yoga therapy.
Yeah.
That would have saved us a whole lot of heartache, wouldn't it have?
It would have. And also, I was very aware of the cost of becoming a yoga therapist.
Right.
And how that's a barrier for so many people. And so if people wanted to do therapeutic yoga, but could only afford to do a 300 hour, then they could do that. And then maybe in 3 or 4 years, they would be financially able to do other tiers. But yeah, I think that way. I'm a really bad promoter and I don't charge what I should, but because I want it to be accessible, I want what I do to be accessible to people.
Yeah. And maybe if we had taken that route, I mean, I don't know what's right and what's wrong at this point, but if we had, maybe all the people that had invested so much heart, soul, finances, time, energy to get the 1,000 hours wouldn't have been upset when the backtrack happened to the 300 or 500. Because it's like, wait a minute.
Yeah.
You can't backtrack on us now. We're the ones who put our lives on hold. So it's so complicated. But let's go back to your story. So you have found a way to be self-empowered and get yourself out of pain for about 15 years.
Yeah.
Then you decide to become a yoga teacher.
Yeah, well, I've always been interested in movement. And I was lucky enough right from that time to find movement teachers in the mind-body tradition. Now we call it somatics. I was interested in dance, and so I took dance classes, and always the universe was guiding me to teachers who were working in that realm. So movement and yoga has always been for me more than the physical, except in the very beginning when I was just learning it. But yoga, as you know, when you practice it, it reaches out and grabs you, and then it becomes your life. And so when I found this yoga teacher, and she's, again, a grandmother of many yoga teachers in Canada, she worked energetically. So she taught us how to move prana and how to access our emotional bodies. What I learned in my first teacher training and in subsequent trainings, I've always been lucky that way to study with people in that mind-body tradition, is that yoga is a transformative process that starts with the body and ends with your whole self.
I love that you're saying this. There's just so much wisdom that comes from doing this since 1974. I am just thrilled to have you here. So how do you differentiate that from somatics? Because I think that's interesting. Where does that line lie for you?
Well, for me, because yoga is union, is connection, is integrating the so-called different aspects of ourselves, I do a lot of somatic type work in my work of experiential anatomy. And so if it's done with that intention of unification of self, then it's yoga. Mm. So when I swim, it's yoga. When I'm having a conversation with my partner, it's yoga. So there's this Sanskrit word, upayoga. Have you ever heard that? Yeah. So Upa yoga is bringing yoga into your life.
Yeah.
And you can bring your yoga into every moment of your life. And so for me, the term somatics, as formulated by Thomas Hanna, designates a particular kind of work. So my main movement teacher, her work, she termed embodied practice. And she called it that before somatics was a big word, you know, because I've been doing this for so long, like trauma sensitive therapy wasn't a thing. Somatic practice wasn't a thing. We called it mind body practice. Yeah. So now everything is somatic. Like there's a zillion things on the internet, on YouTube and Instagram, that are calling what it is somatics, but it's not really somatics, because somatics is the lived experience of being in a body. It's not just, oh, do this movement and your back will feel better. It's, if you do this movement, you will become aware of yourself at a deeper level. You will become aware of your habits, both on a physical level, on an emotional level, on a mental level, and you will use that information to shift your perspective and your behavior. That's somatics. It's the lived experience of being in a body.
Yeah, I'm just going to leave it there. You said it so beautifully. So let's go back to you. When was the second time that you found Ayurveda and or yoga to kind of help you?
Yeah. Well, this is a big chunk of my life, because in 2001, I got really sick. And it was eventually diagnosed as chronic fatigue syndrome. I had to give up my practice as a massage therapist. I was sleeping 16 hours a day. And then a couple of years later, I developed inflammatory arthritis systemically. And so not only was I extremely exhausted all the time, but I was in excruciating pain to the point where I could barely walk, and all of my joints were swollen like grapefruits, and I was pretty miserable, I have to say. And this studio is in the lower floor of our house. We're on a hill, so there's an entrance to the studio. We live upstairs. And so I could hobble down to this studio one step at a time, hanging on to the banister, and I have all of my equipment here. And so I could do, again, about 45 minutes of practice. I could get the swelling down a little bit so that I could walk a little bit. By that time, actually, I started teaching yoga therapy because I got sick and had to let go of my massage therapy practice. And one of my students said to me, you know, you've been talking for years about teaching an experiential anatomy yoga therapy program. And I thought, being my type A personality, well, I've got all this space in my life because I don't have my clinic anymore. So why don't I just start a yoga therapy program? So I did.
What year was that?
That was 2001.
Okay.
Yeah. And I was still really sick. When I look back on it, I think, how did you do that? Like, that was really stupid. But anyways, it got me two books. And I realize now that that was my process for healing, or part of my process for healing. Just like I learned yoga from a book, by this time, I would just come down here and I would play with all of my tools, my balls and my rolls, and get myself at least out of enough pain so that I could function a little better during the day. And then what happened was that course took me through every part of the body and all of the systems of the body. And like I say, got me two books. And by the end of it, there's an Ayurvedic part in there that I'll get to. By the end of it, I realized that that work had healed me. And what I mean by that is that when you're sick and you're in pain, you don't really want to be in your body. right? So there's a dissociation. And although I was probably more embodied than a lot of people, even dissociated, what I realized was that as I developed the practices for each part of the body, that I was getting myself back.
Were you somatically embodying all of these different areas as you figured out what to teach?
Yeah, well, because I've missed that piece, I teach experiential anatomy. And I was lucky enough, the same year I graduated from massage college, which up here is a 2-year full-time process. So we learn anatomy and physiology at a university level. I discovered experiential anatomy in the body-mind centering tradition. And I was totally fascinated because when I graduated, I realized that there's something missing here. Like I can palpate, I can work with individual muscles and tissues, but it didn't feel complete. And when I discovered experiential anatomy, it was like, oh, wow, this is amazing because it involves all of me. And so again, I'm an autodidact, so I teach myself a lot of things. So I just got books. I'd been introduced to Mabel Todd's The Thinking Body way back in the 80s. And there were some other books published, Karen McCose and Andrea Olson, Body Stories. And so there was starting to be some books. And so I would take those books and I would just riff on them. And that's how I developed my anatomy of yoga therapy, is what I called it. And what it does is now I have the language for it because of all the research in the last 20 years on interoception. Now I have a language for why it works and how it can help people to develop a deeper sense of self and to become more self-compassionate, to have more self-knowledge, and using that to self-regulate. So it's always a pathway, isn't it? Like you being now where you need to be. And I have really felt that in my life, that there was this golden thread that was leading me exactly where I needed to be, learning, being exposed to the people and the information, the knowledge that I needed in order for me to develop into who I'm meant to be.
So first of all, everyone, go back, rewind 15 seconds. Every single person listening has a golden thread. They don't know what it is. You don't see the golden thread when you're living the golden thread. You could only see it looking back like, oh my gosh, this was so amazing. So number one, everyone have faith that you too have a golden thread and it's unfolding perfectly, even though you don't believe it, even though you're doubting it, even though you think you're the only one who probably doesn't have a golden thread. You have one. I'd like to take just a moment away from the episode to tell you about something that's really precious to us here at The Optimal State. And that's our Monday night Sangha. There are so many of us that have come together for several years now on Monday nights. It's about an hour and a half class where we really set ourselves up for the week. We start with talking about one of the Yoga Sutra of Patanjali's as it pertains to our topic of the month. So in November, that is kind of reflecting on 2025 and thinking about how to go inward for November and December and really settle ourselves before we move into the new year. So we'll choose Yoga Sutra that are all about reflecting, all about going inward. And then possibly towards the end of the month, talk about setting intentions with powerful manifestation and how do we have a great 2026? So that's our topic for November. We do a little discussion, we do some postures, some breath work, a little bit of yoga nidra meditation, and then we come back at the end for another discussion. These are really potent sessions to start your week off right. We invite all of you. You can be there live or watch the recording, but we would love to have you with us on Monday nights, especially as we move into 2026. All right, everybody, let's get back to the podcast and thank you for listening.
And even when you're deep in suffering.
Yes.
Right, because now I know that I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing now if I hadn't got that sick and be forced to let go of something I loved to do, which was teaching yoga in the studio, but being a massage therapist. I loved it. I was the therapist of last resort for many people because I worked the way that I did, which is involving that person in their own healing process and empowering them. So
hard
it was
to let go when you're good at it, people appreciate it, you're getting paid well. Like, why would you ever let go of that to become this butterfly that is now doing very different and profound, long, far-reaching work? But before we go there, Lila, I have to back up because there are people listening that don't really know what you mean by experiential anatomy. I want to contrast here, and then I want you to comment. So when I was in college in the 1980s, I took anatomy class, and we memorized the bones and the joints and the muscles, the origins, the insertions. We looked at the ranges of motion. We looked at the different ways each joint would fold and rotate and flex and extend, right? And that was that. We graduated, and we were like, amazing, we know anatomy now. That was it. And now, not only do we know how much the nervous system impacts all of it, we know that there's this thing called fascia, which impacts all of it. But even more than that, I think what you're saying is our emotions impact our movement patterns and our pain, our thoughts, our way of being in the world, our personalities, our type A personalities are causing, sad to say, but things like chronic fatigue and fibromyalgia. So can you unpack experiential anatomy? Because it's just so different than how we were taught in the 80s and 90s. And I want everyone to understand that anatomy has gone to a whole new place now.
Yeah. So what you are describing is intellectual information that stays in the brain. It might inform how you work, but just it's intellectual information. And experiential anatomy is an embodied learning method that takes intellectual information. So it starts with intellectual information. So I still want people to, like, I have my skeleton and my models and my anatomy books. I still want people to be able to have a picture and an understanding of what things look like, what their size, what's their location, what do they do, how do they move. That's important information. But the second step in experiential anatomy is we have to take that intellectual information into the body and develop a felt sense of whatever structure we're focusing on. So whether it's the fascial system, whether it's the nervous system, whether it's the spine. So as an example, with taking the spine, I would have my spinal model. People would understand the three zones, that the three zones have different movement capacities, that there's spinous processes, that there's transverse processes. And then we would take that into the body. So in partners or with a band or something, people would start to feel, okay, that's my spinous process. Those are my spinous processes. Those are my transverse processes. And I can initiate flexion and extension from my spinous processes. Or I can initiate a twist from my transverse processes. And oh, isn't that different than when I just do a forward bend or a back bend? It's creating a felt sense of a structure which wakes up the intelligence of that structure. So every cell has an intelligence, right? Has a wisdom. And so when we go that deep into the body, then not only is it awakening the intelligence of that structure, but it's creating, it's refining the maps, the sensory and motor maps in the brain. And so it creates this gestalt of experience because all of those processes, the interoceptive process, really the interoceptive process, that's what it's all about. It, as you know, connects with the limbic system, with the cerebral cortex, so that all of us are become involved in that experience. So it becomes the lived body. And then the third step for me of experiential anatomy is taking that embodied awareness into everyday life and into your movement practice, whether it's yoga or sports or whatever. So I have golfers or hockey players who say they're better at what they do because of experiential anatomy. Or I swim from my spine or from my pelvis as an engine. You know, so what it does is it brings healing, because this work is healing work. It brings the healing into every moment of every day, because your awareness can be, how am I reaching for that? How am I walking? If I bring this awareness into it, then how does that change? Is that better? Is that neutral? Or is it not helpful? So experiential anatomy is a living process that is really yoga, because it's bringing in all of the koshas. So
I want to give an example of this, because I'm doing it right now. I've had some back pain recently. And when I walk, I'm aware of, oh, there's the zing. Okay, it's on the left side today, or it's on the right side. It's a little higher, a little lower. How does it feel when I use my walking sticks? Does that make it feel better? Does that make it feel worse? What if I take a longer stride? What if I take a shorter stride? What if I step side to side every once in a while just to give myself different ranges of motion? What if I lean up against the fence and do a little forward bend every 10 minutes in my walk? Like, I'm kind of using my own body as a laboratory to figure out what works for me. Does it work better if I do my yoga stretching before or after? What if I break it up into morning and evening walk instead of one long walk? Like, I'm really wanting to get my steps and movement in, but I'm also needing to honor this pain signal that is talking to me. Does it make a difference if I drink more water? Does it make a difference if I'm talking politics with my husband? And in fact, it does.
Absolutely. Yeah. So that's bringing all of you into it. And then to bring the experiential anatomy piece into it, it might be, how does the pain change when I initiate my walk from my psoas muscles or from my spinal engine? Or how does it change when I walk with my foot triangles? So that's how we would bring experiential anatomy into that.
Or even just focusing on kind of bringing my core in a little bit and not allowing so much lordosis. So kind of just taking my abdomen in a little bit and focusing on my transverse abdominis to kind of stabilize things down there. It makes such a big difference.
Because when you walk from your psoas, anytime you do something with experiential anatomy, it takes you more into core automatically without having to think, oh, that's my transverse abdominis or that's my multifidus. But although that can be helpful too, but as soon as you go into the bones using experiential anatomy, then it's automatically going to take you into core.
So you're saying the psoas is a deeper muscle closer to the bones, and therefore a focus on the psoas, it's a little bit more control, more deeper connection with self than maybe the transverse abdominis, which is laying on top of that.
Yeah. And when you're visualizing the condensing of the psoas lifting your leg, then you are exerting more motor control.
Mm.
Anytime you're focusing on experiential anatomy, you have better motor control and you're developing your proprioception and your interoception and all of those good things.
I love that. I love that. Well, I will try that tonight. I've already done my morning walk. I'll try it tonight. I'm going to initiate from the psoas, and
it starts high. It starts just under the solar plexus. You want to think about your legs starting at your solar plexus.
Wow. All right. So we have learned what experiential anatomy is. I think one more thing I need you to unpack. I'm sorry to just break it down to this, but I consider the podcast kind of a learning. They're getting something for listening, our audience. Interoception. Can you just give us a brief definition? Because I think that's a new word for a lot of people.
Yeah, well, interoception is a process, and there's various definitions of it. But the one that I like is it's the process of the perception integration and processing of signals from various places and integrated with limbic, with cerebral cortex. And the output is motivation, is emotion, and is self-regulation. So interoception, we used to think of it just in terms of what's happening unconsciously, what's happening in our digestive system, or our gallbladder is releasing bile. There is an unconscious visceral aspect to it, but we can also bring interception into consciousness, because for me, it's a sense of armness, that I have an arm and that it's the feeling sense. So proprioception is the perception of movement in space and relationship to ground, to other parts of the body. Interception is how does that feel in my body? So experiential anatomy is based on interception. So when I consciously connect my arm to my heart, or through fascia to the sternum and the spine, then it's a different kind of movement. So the interoceptive process takes signals, proprioceptive signals, interoceptive signals, vestibular signals, signals from the fascia, the unmyelinated nerve endings in the fascia, and is fed into the process. And so the better the sensory signals in, the better the output. That's why it's important in somatic work to practice pratyahara. So withdrawing the awareness from the outer world and focusing on one thing, focusing on the movement of my spine or focusing on my breath. We want to narrow the scope of awareness so that the noise doesn't distract the nervous system.
All right. So I usually have one hard question for each guest. And here's your hard question. I hope people don't take this as I'm trying to be mean or anything. Usually these are like, I'm really curious about this because it's something that is hard for me to figure out. And that is that many times when someone has lost connection, interoceptive awareness with their own body due to trauma, due to being neurodivergent, maybe even being overweight has somehow caused a disconnection with the signals deep in the body. And there's many, many other reasons that this can happen. Depression. How do you get people feeling again? Because when I start with people trying to get them to work with interoceptive awareness, as I call it, they just say, I don't feel anything. I don't know what you're talking about. And I just say, let's just keep trying to bring our attention to this area, see if you can eventually find the spot and maybe put a hand on it gently. But it takes many, many sessions for them to finally come and feel something. It's almost like there just is no felt sense. So what do you think? What do you do?
Well, that's why I go through the three-step process. If people have a picture, you know, they've got the models, I think that's really important. Touching themselves, but initiating movement also is very helpful. And I use sound and breath. So they might breathe into that area. They might hum into that area. I've got a whole series of practices that help people get that sense. So there's many different ways of coming in. If people don't really understand the concept of interoception, then I remind them, well, what does it feel like when you're hungry or when you're thirsty or when you're cold? Like you feel some kind of sensation, right? And also I ask the question, how do you know that you're breathing? How do you know that you have an arm? How do you know that you're bending at that joint? Because there's something. I think it's a matter of, Norman Farb calls it sensory sense foraging. Mm. Yeah. You go searching for the sensations, and searching for the sensations takes us out of our habit mind. So it might be concepts that are preventing that person from touching into their feeling. It might be a concept of whatever the conceptual habit is or the thought habit is. So when you go into sensation, even just thinking about sensation, like what do you think that would feel like, then that's going to start shifting the whole interceptive process. So yeah, it takes time. It's not an instant thing. I remember as a massage therapist, for example, I had a patient who could just not feel when a trigger point released. She just could not feel it. And then she took some yoga classes, not from me, from someone else. And when she came back some months later, all of a sudden she could feel not just the trigger point release, but she could feel energy moving. You know, when it released, she could feel the energy moving down her arm or whatever. So it's a process and it requires dedication, commitment, motivation, and trust. Trust that eventually you will feel something. You know, as one of my massage therapy teachers used to say, you will come to know.
Yeah.
And I would say, you will come to feel.
That maybe the reason we aren't feeling is the body, mind, spirit is protecting us.
Absolutely.
And that it can unfold gently and slowly over time to allow those feelings and sensations that were once intolerable for whatever reason, that they're allowed to come back and be held and felt and seen and, you know.
Yeah. Well, I'll give you an example. One of my trainees, I didn't know this, had a trauma background, childhood sexual abuse background. And back then when I was teaching, trauma sensitive wasn't a thing, somatics wasn't a thing. But what she said after the process is that, and she studied with me for many years, is that when she started the training, she had no idea what grounding meant, what centering meant, what embodiment meant. But through the process, and the example that she gave is she could feel her femur. She knew she could trust her femur would always be her femur, you know, because with that history, there was always this uncertainty and not trusting. And so through the process of going part by part by part during the course, she came to trust her body and herself. And she understood what grounding means when you're in your feet and in your pelvis. And centering means, well, I can find my center by going to my spine or my spinal cord or Sushumna, right? And part by part, she got herself back.
That's so beautiful.
Yeah. So I think of it as trauma therapy through the back door. So we don't address the trauma, but we just say, okay, well, let's see what's safe for you in your body. And maybe that's starting with your fingers and your toes, because that's usually pretty safe.
Yeah. I love that. I love that we don't go in and address the trauma head on and what happened and kind of reinforce the story and the feel, you know, that instead we're like, let's introduce you to a feeling sensation in your body again that's safe, and let's just slowly build on that over time.
Yeah. And I always start with the feet, so that's pretty safe.
Yeah. So Lila, I assume that you came out of this chronic fatigue and the arthritis through all of the teachings and learnings and sharings and experiencings that you had over this long period of time. But you said there was a third time that yoga and or Ayurveda had kind of saved you. What's the third one?
Well, Ayurveda really saved me from the chronic fatigue and the arthritis. I'd been sick for 9 years by the time I got to India for my first 3-week Panchakarma. After 3 weeks, I didn't have grapefruit knees anymore. My knees were just like normal knees again. And I had been in a wheelchair in the airport because I couldn't walk. And I mean, I still had to be in a wheelchair the next time I went. But over time, I think it took 3 times before they started giving me heavy duty treatments because I was so sick. But again, patience. First time I got my hope back. The second time I got some energy back. The third time I got my joy back. Like each time I went, there was a huge shift. And each time I went, there was not just a physical shift, but there would be some kind of recalibration in the other koshas. It was quite dramatic. And so I credit really Ayurveda for my healing. And then writing the second book, which is my sort of opus on experiential anatomy taken from the training that I taught. During that time, I hadn't really got my jive back and I was feeling really unself-confident and afraid to be in the world because I'd been out of the world for so long. I hadn't got my groove back. But going through the practices over and over and over again, writing the book, you know, trying to get just the right language for the practices, by the end of the book, I realized that I got myself back. I got my jive back and I was fully embodied. So now I feel like I can be in the world with confidence, with, you know, here I am kind of thing. And so the Ayurveda got me to the place where I could even contemplate being in the world. And then writing the book and the practices got me to the place where, yes, you can be in the world with confidence, with vitality, and share what you've learned.
It is so powerful to hear that. Number one, just watching you over all the years that I've seen you out there, I would have never, ever guessed that you had lost your jive. Like, show up so looking so radiant and colorful with the beautiful halo of golden hair and the bright eyes. Like, who would ever guess that you even went through that?
I think my pranic body was always pretty strong. And people would say that, well, you look great. And I would say, well, I wish that I felt as good as I look, but I'm really glad I don't look as bad as I feel.
As women are aging, the whole thing about how we look and how we feel, I'm sorry I'm laughing, but it really is a thing.
It is a thing.
Oh, goodness. So as we close up here, in your mind, what happened that suddenly, I mean, you had your pranic flow, but what happened that gave you the confidence to come out and teach this to all of us?
I think for me, you teach what you need to learn. Yeah, you teach what you need to learn. And of course, I didn't know that I needed to learn that. Even though throughout my life, I've projected confidence, there was a disconnect inside. So I was extremely shy and unconfident inside. And so what the process of creating the work and writing about it and teaching about it has done for me is it's brought congruence between what's inside and what's outside.
Beautiful. Yeah. So let's just take a moment to look at your beautiful website, lilastuart.com, LeilaStuart, lilastuart.com.
Lila.
Lila. Thank you. And what is experiential anatomy? You describe it. You talk about your classes and your workshops. You have an about section, resources, videos, audio, blog. We could go to your book, Experiential Anatomy. And what is the second book?
The second book I wrote with Donna Fari, it's based on the SOAS module of my training. And she had asked if she could use some of my handouts in her trainings and found such incredible results that she asked me if I wanted to co-write a book with her. So
and
we
that's
did.
Called Pathways to a Centered Body.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And one thing I have to say about your books is that they're beautiful. It's an experience of savoring, like these beautiful pictures. Was that intentional for you? Do you value that kind of beauty and art?
Aesthetics, for sure. Yeah, it's very important to me.
Yeah.
Well, and because it's evocative, having simplicity in a yoga studio brings a certain energy, and having something beautiful evokes something in you. When you look at it, you know, just like a beautiful music or reading a poem, it's evocative.
Yeah, it's true. So any last words of wisdom for us?
Well, I think that everybody should learn some experiential anatomy that it takes you in. Like there's this rich world inside of us, whether it's bones, muscles, fascia, organs, energy currents, emotions. Like there's this incredible world inside of us that when we access it, we are accessing our wholeness and we can live from our wholeness. And yoga taught with somatic awareness takes you into that, takes you inside so that you can live from your wholeness. You can express in the world your whole self, not your segmented self. And so I guess my message would be go in, go in.
And I am so happy that our anatomy teacher at what is now Maryland University of Integrative Health, soon to become Notre Dame of Maryland University. Our merger will have gone through by the time this airs and MUIH will no longer exist. We will only be Notre Dame. But our anatomy teacher, her name is Kimberly Searle, and she has chosen your experiential anatomy book as our Masters in Yoga Therapy anatomy course book. So how do you feel about that?
I am absolutely thrilled. And it was my hope that the book would be used in yoga therapy trainings. Because when I taught my course, I taught it for almost 15 years, people would say, why don't we know this? Like, why don't more people know this? So yeah, and now it's also being added to the reading list at the California one.
Oh, Loyola Marymount University?
Yeah, Loyola Marymount, yeah. And when Lori reviews it, she said, you know, she might use it. Right now, she says she'll put it on the reading list. And when I recommend books, people buy them. So,
Lori Rubenstein.
Yeah, Lori, yeah. And it's written as a text to learn how to teach experiential anatomy and also how to learn it, because you have to learn it before you can teach it. And it's based on the Koshic model. So it's going through all those levels. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, congratulations. I love seeing you reintegrate into this wholeness and bringing your whole self forward for all of us to learn from you. So thank you so much.
It's been an absolute pleasure, Amy. Thank you for this.
Thank you, Lila, for being with us today. It was so lovely to get to know you a little bit better and to really understand your work, that it's an internal sensory experience that we're having when we're learning anatomy. There's not the prefrontal cortex just memorizing the bones and the muscles and the insertions and the origins, that we're actually going inward and feeling all of this from the inside out. And that is how we're really going to learn experiential anatomy. Now, there's one thing that if we had had a lot more time, I would have asked Lila to go into, but I think because some of you are watching this on YouTube, you know that we have the audio version and then we have the video version on YouTube. And I just want to show you what we're talking about when we say it takes time to focus and feel and sense, and that we have to have faith and hope that it can be rewired, that our body and our brain can reconnect again. And I want to show you exactly what is happening from a neuroscience perspective, because I think it's so important for you to know what's happening so that you have faith that it can be rewired and you can start to be embodied as we saw Lila was able to. So in your brain, you have the motor cortex and the sensory cortex. And if you're looking at the screen, you can see that there are little folds in your brain, each one corresponding to a knee or a hip or your spine or a shoulder, arm, elbow, wrist, hand, fingers, neck, eye, face, lips, jaw, tongue, that we get sensory information from the body, moving up the spinal cord, finding a place in the brain that corresponds with the body. So, for example, your finger touches something hot, there's a signal that runs down your arm up to the spinal cord, up to your brain that says, wow, this finger just felt something hot. So that's a sensory experience. And sometimes up in the brain, it's kind of smudged. The signal can't really get through very well to tell the brain that, oh my gosh, this is hot. Now, similarly, there's this place in the brain that's then going to send a signal back down the spinal cord, down the arm to the finger to tell it what it needs to know and to give it a connection between the brain and the body. And if that place in the brain is kind of smudged, that signal going back down to the body doesn't work very well. And so this is what's happened with people who are disembodied, maybe have a lot of trauma, maybe they have neurodivergence, diversity. Maybe, like I said, there could be a variety of reasons why this is happening. But the hope that I want to give you is that these areas that are smudged on the brain, where the senses coming up or the motor control going back down from the brain to the body, that we can reprogram that. I call it desmudging. And that just means we can wake it up again. We can get those body-brain connections working well again. So when we say it takes some time, that's what we mean, is that you have to keep working on it and go on that sensory scavenger hunt inside your body to start reconnecting back up there to the brain. And that is hopeful that we can all do that. It takes longer for some people than others, but it is possible for all of us to reconnect those neural pathways. All right. Well, everybody, it's been wonderful to be with you today. Please keep in mind that a lot of this type of information around neuroscience and the body and the brain and yogic philosophy, we do have classes at Optimal State on Monday nights. We're going to start a whole new thing in 2026, starting in January. We're going to go through the 8 limbs of yoga month by month. It's going to take us about 15 months, believe it or not. And we're going to kind of use yoga philosophy, the 8 limbs of yoga, and neuroscience for about 15 months to bring it all together. So it is experiential. And there are also CEs available for those of you who like to do continuing education. So join us starting in January 2026. We will have month by month course. You can join for 1 month. You can join for the whole 15 months. And we look forward to being with you during that time to really explore these kinds of concepts quite deeply. All right. Thank you for listening. Thank you for listening to the Yoga Therapy Hour. We appreciate you as our listeners, because without you, there would be no Yoga Therapy Hour. It's your comments, your calls, your emails, your texts of support and well wishes and affirmations that keeps us going. So don't feel hesitant to give us a review if you've been enjoying the podcast. Go wherever it is that you listen, find the review section, and let people know how much you love the Yoga Therapy Hour. It's a small thing that you could do for us that would help spread the word of goodness, benevolence, and help us help all the people out there to suffer less. All right, everybody, have a great week. We'll see you next week. Thank you for listening to the Yoga Therapy Hour. We wish you a wonderful week. We hope that somehow, in a small way, we've contributed to your well-being so that you can go out and share that well-being with others. That's what life is all about, bringing in the goodness through you and then shining it out to the world. We need you more than ever. So let's all get out there, do good, be good, and have a great week.